This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. Facebook and Twitter came under a cyber attack this week, interrupting service to 45 million Twitter users alone. To some, it was merely annoying, to others, disconcerting. But there is a political backstory that goes way beyond Silicon Valley. Joining us now to help sort it out is Evgeny Morozov. He's a blogger for Foreign Policy. He's in the studio. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
The subject of the attack was one person, and I think you've referred to him as the first, is it the first digital refugee?
That's right.
Tell us about him.
Well, he's a blogger. He was actually from Abkhazia, from one of the breakaway republics of Georgia. And he was a real refugee because he had to flee Abkhazia in the first Georgian War in the early 90s. And since then, he has taken to blogging to express his nostalgia for the times that passed and to blog about Georgian politics. Last year, he emerged as one of the most trenchant critics of the war that was happening between Georgia in Russia, in South Ossetia, another breakaway region. And his blogging was rankling so many people, I guess, in Russia, or could be people close to the Kremlin, that his blog became a subject of very frequent cyber attacks, which basically made it impossible for his readers to access the blog and for him to blog and post any new posts. And he was doing it on first on one site, LiveJournal, which is a very popular blogging platform in Russia. Then he diversified as his LiveJournal blog became a frequent target of attacks and moved to Twitter, Facebook, Blogspot, and other platforms. And attacks followed him there. So as we have seen this week, on the anniversary of the Russian-Georgian War of last year, all of his accounts on different social media sites became targets. The attacks were so severe that the entire service was actually unavailable. So it's not only him, it's other, 44 million people who use Twitter who became hostages in this cyber attack.
Any indication that this was a part of that geopolitical battle, for example, that the hackers could have come from the Kremlin?
Well, it makes for a very plausible explanation. However, it's very hard right now to second guess because you never know who benefited most. This blogger himself suddenly became a celebrity. Georgia is also benefiting as a country because suddenly people are talking about this obscure war, which few people remember about these days. And it's very hard to see what exactly Kremlin itself and the Russian politicians would actually gain from it. Because what he was doing was punditry. It wasn't investigative reporting, and it wasn't breaking new stories that would somehow undermine the Kremlin's position on the war. So it's very hard to guess who would benefit most from it. What we know is that we don't know who was behind the attacks, and there is no way to trace it at this point.
The fact that this one man caused this ripple effect throughout two systems, Twitter and Facebook. What are the chances that Twitter and Facebook might say to this blogger, you can't use our site anymore because of all the attacks against you and we can't handle it?
I think right now, with him generating headlines all over the media, it's very unlikely that LiveJournal and Facebook will proceed to do that. But I think there are many other examples like him, which are much less visible. Many of them are not as political as he is. For example, you have all sorts of groups fighting for gay and lesbian rights, for example. You have all sorts of dissident groups from Burma, who are also frequent subjects of cyber attacks, and they're being forced off their online platform because they cause a lot of headache to their companies who host them, but they bring very little profit. So there is this very big problem how to preserve freedom of expression online in the future.
Evgeny Morozov writes the Net Effect blog for Foreign Policy. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me.
You may have heard about the case of the disappearing e-books, and we're not talking about a new Nancy Drew novel. The online retailer Amazon deleted some of George Orwell's books from its Kindle readers after it discovered that the books had come from an unauthorized reseller. Orwell lovers were not happy about the Orwellian solution.
I saw the story about Amazon removing George Orwell books from people's Kindles, and 1984 was the last book that I was reading. So I went upstairs, turned my Kindle on. Within a few seconds, the screen refreshed and it was completely gone from my device.
That was Justin Goronsky, a 17-year-old high school student in Michigan. He's suing Amazon over the deletion of his book. To find out more about Justin's case, go to npr.org/soapbox and read the latest from Queen Akim and cyberfrequencies.com, a website and podcast devoted to stories that are buzzing on the web. It's all part of Maker's Quest, a project of the Association of Independents in Radio and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
This is Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow. You know, sometimes the old ways may be the best ways, and that may be true when it comes to solar energy. Solar engineers have announced that they have set a new record for energy production efficiency by taking two old concepts, the solar reflector and the Stirling engine, combining them together and creating a device that converts solar energy to electricity with an efficiency greater than 30%. And those Stirling engine solar dishes, thousands of them positioned out in the Mojave Desert, will soon become part of the renewable energy future of California, which is leading the way in converting to green renewable energies. So, how soon before we see those dishes tracking the sun? And what about those panels on your roof, those other kinds of solar generators? Why do we need installations out in the desert if there are so many open roofs? That's what we'll be talking about this hour. Our number 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. You can also tweet us at our tweet location. That's at SciFry, at SCIFRI. Let me introduce my guests. Mark Mihos is a program manager for the Concentrating Solar Power Program at the Department of Energy's National Renewable Energy Lab in Golden, Colorado. Welcome back to SciFry.
Happy to be here.
Thank you. Steve Kalman is CEO and board member for Stirling Energy Systems in Scottsdale, Arizona. Welcome to Science Friday, Mr. Kalman.
Morning, Ira. How you doing?
Mark, a lot of people probably think that solar panels or a lot of PV panels on rooftops. This solar concept is different, though, right?
Yes, it is, Ira. This is what a good friend of mine and a colleague, Fred Morris, likes to call the other white beat. When people think of solar energy, often they think of what you are starting to see a lot of in the U.S. and around the world, these solar panels or photovoltaic systems. And this is not that. These are systems that use concentrating optics, typically mirrors, as you described earlier, to generate very high temperatures that are used to heat a working fluid that drives some sort of a working turbine or a Stirling engine in the case of the system we're talking about.
Tell us how you were able to break that record for efficiency.
Well, I think that's better for our other guests to discuss, although the national laboratories, both NREL and our sister laboratory, Sandia National Laboratory, have worked with Stirling Energy Systems on their particular technology, the Stirling engine, to help them break that record.
Well, Mark, let's talk about it. What did you do? You have a very impressive picture what looks to be like the old reflector with an engine sitting in the focal point.
That's right. I mean, I suppose just as Mark said there, the PV has been around, photovoltaics have been around for probably 40 years. They're, very reliable, obviously used quite widely. Concentrating solar thermal has been an emerging technology for a number of years, and there's a couple of different technologies. The trough technology is pretty reasonably well deployed, particularly the SEGS plants in California. And there are some new concentrating solar thermal technologies, for example, the tower technology and the Stirling engine. So there's a number of different concentrating solar thermal. The technology we have is just one of a suite of different technologies that are out there. And there's an application-specific dimension to them. Some work well in certain applications. Some are best suited for other applications. Our system is a 25-kilowatt system, so it's a modular design. And as Mark said there, really developed jointly with the Sandia Labs, and we've done a lot of the testing there. And, in fact, that's where we actually broke the world record, for plus 30% effectively sun to grid-scale electricity production.
Why does the Stirling engine work so well? Describe it for us a bit.
Well, the Stirling engine, in fact, the Stirling engine was invented back in 1816. So as
pretty old.
Yeah, it's been around a long time. So so the engine itself has been around a long time. And I suppose really, you know, what in terms of the technology we have here, the Stirling engine is a 25-kilowatt system. So, for example, for the first project which we will have in California, it'll be 12,000 of these deployed to generate 300 megawatts of power. So what you have really is you've got an engine that generates 25 kilowatts of electrical power that sits in a dish reflector. You get about a concentration of about 1,100 suns, and that concentrated heat actually drives the Stirling engine. The Stirling engine is an external combustion engine, so at a temperature of about 740 degrees C, the Stirling engine actually, which is, uses hydrogen as an internal fluid, actually uses that heat to drive the engine, to drive a generator to produce the power.
Mark, there seems to be, though, one shortcoming in the Stirling engines as they are used now is that there is no way to store the electricity or store the power when the sun's not shining.
And shortcoming, I guess, would be a strong word for it. But the, as described, there are different applications for different technologies. The some of the other technologies can make better use of thermal storage. And what we do with those technologies, and specifically that would be the parabolic trough and the central receiver technology, is to take that working fluid and you essentially bottle up some of that working fluid during the day. You drive your generator with that working fluid during the daytime. But then when a cloud comes over or at night or late in the evening, you take that leftover working fluid and you can use that to continue to drive your generator. And typically in this case, it would be a steam generator, not a Stirling engine.
Mm-hmm. Let's get a call in 1-800-989-8255. Simon in Troy, Michigan. Hi, Simon.
Yes, hi. How are you doing?
Hi there.
Thanks for taking my call. I have a question. For solar panels, why don't we put them in the middle of the road? Because I understand that they cover up a lot of area, and then anything that's below probably has problem growing or anything, so you can't really put them in forage or anything else. But
yeah,
the medium strip of the road isn't really being used for anything.
That's a great idea. Why don't we do that, Steve? Could you put those also in the middle? Could you make a smaller version of your Stirling system? Maybe put it on a rooftop also.
Well, you could do that. I suppose really, you know, I mean, when a lot of people think about PV, they think about it mainly for domestic type applications. I mean, we're really focused on utility grid scale. Mm-hmm. You know, so typical projects would be, you know, 200, 300, all the way up to 750 megawatts, you know, providing enough heat, light, and power for, you know, typically population centers of about 500,000 up to about 2 million people. But you can certainly do that. I mean, you know, that's, I suppose, the beauty of PV is that you can actually deploy it, providing you have, you know, the right type of sunlight, but provide you have the ability to connect it to a grid.
Mm. Mark, why not put all these photovoltaic systems on rooftops? There are a lot of rooftops around. And, like, you know, I know California has the Million Rooftop Project, right?
That's right. A million isn't enough, though.
It's not enough.
And it's a good question. There are a lot of people asking that question, and there's a couple of points that come up. One is one can just look at the number of rooftops, both residential rooftops or commercial industrial rooftops. And at NREL, we've done a lot of that analysis, and that analysis points to the fact that there just aren't enough rooftops. If you start looking at the orientation that you would need to best produce that electricity, and if you start looking at shading, then really what you're left with is somewhere around, let's say, 20% of the U.S. generation capacity could be served by those rooftop systems.
Mm-hmm. Steve, I know you said that you're building on the industrial scale for industrial applications. Is it possible to build a home version, a smaller working version that would work, you know, on a rooftop?
Well, it is, yeah. I mean, the 25-kilowatt system that we produce would be way too big for a domestic application.
Right.
But there is smaller Stirling engine systems out there that run at typically 1, 2, or 3 kilowatts. But again, I mean, our focus has mainly been on the, you know, large-scale utility-style projects. But you can certainly make a smaller Stirling engine. I suppose one of the issues, actually, is the, you know, our strategy really is it's high-volume manufacturing. And, you know, the engine, for example, will be made using a lot of the capacity that's currently not being utilized up in, you know, Detroit and Michigan. I mean, if you take, you know, the Detroit car market, they made 17 million cars in 2007. That dropped to less than 10 million cars last year. So there's a lot of available capacity. So we're looking to tap into that capacity for both the engine, for the dish, for the mirror and the facet. So, and, you know, high volume manufacturing allows you to drive down the costs, which allows you to be economical in terms of the end market. So it's that's the segment that we have really focused on. But you could certainly do it for domestic applications, but it would require a much smaller engine.
You know, I hear more and more of this, Mark, that the demand is there, but you just can't build the parts fast enough. I am thinking about wind also. You know, you can't build those turbines, or maybe you can't build the solar collectors fast enough.
Well, that can be correct. I think one of the advantages of concentrating solar power technologies is that they really don't rely on any special materials. They are more or less readily available. We're using steel and glass and mirrors and turbines, but we do need to build up that industry that can produce those materials. And so DOE has a large effort, a growing effort, in just trying to build up a U.S. industry rather than having that industry lie abroad.
Mm-hmm. And it would certainly be good stimulus money well spent.
We hope so, and some money is going that direction.
Mm-hmm. Like those are as well. I mean, you know, I think there's two things here. I mean, you need the demand side equation. I think the, you know, the recent RPS targets that have come out from at both federal and state level is mandating a higher amount of electricity coming from renewables. And on top of that, you've got, you know, the innovative stimulus package that the President Obama's administration is actually rolling out to help fund these projects. So, you know, although the credit markets are particularly tight and funding for large-scale projects is difficult, you know, there is almost the perfect storm out there at the moment where you've got, you know, the utilities companies who are looking to bring on more renewables, and you've got the stimulus package that allows you to fund the projects, and you've got available capacity, you know, with a lot of the automakers in terms of spare capacity there. And I suppose, you know, so that's creating the context to actually really drive these large projects out there. Because what solar thermal really needs is to gain momentum, to drive volume, to get the cost down. Because
Can it be competitive with other forms of electricity?
I mean, absolutely.
In a kilowatt hour.
Yeah, I mean, well, wind has been around for 10, 12 years. It's a really good technology. It's very reliable. And they've done a really good job of coming down the cost curve. So they're, you know, sub 10 cents per kilowatt hour. The problem with wind is that, you know, where it's a very good renewable technology, it's intermittent. It's not, you know, the wind doesn't always blow when you need it. So, you know, a good solar solution is a very nice complement to wind. Mm-hmm. But obviously for that solar solution to work, you've got to have a product that's cost effective and it's reliable. Mm-hmm. So the answer to the question is yes, you can definitely get down the cost curve. You know, certainly from our point of view, we're competitive at the market reference point in California. And, you know, I think once we drive volume through the supply chain that we have and we work on the technology side, no reason why you can't get solar down close to where wind is.
All right, gentlemen, thank you very much for taking time to talk with us today.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Steve Kalman is CEO and board member for Sterling Energy Systems. That's in Scottsdale, Arizona. And Mark Mihos is program manager for the Concentrating Solar Power Program at the National Renewable Energy Lab in Golden, Colorado.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. The world's libraries are moving online, and Google is doing much of the work. The company has scanned 7 million books and counting. The prospect of a virtual super library excites many people and also raises concerns that as books go digital, the act of reading may become less private. NPR's Martin Costi reports.
Novelist Jonathan Lethem says books should be intimate. He thinks back to when he was young, when he was discovering literature.
When I was on this very private, very eccentric, intense journey as a younger person, it was crucial that it be a solitary practice.
Lethem wonders whether future readers will enjoy the same kind of solitude. With digital books, he says, readers will be able to discover new kinds of literature, but they may also be constantly mindful of the fact that their reading choices can be recorded. The Google Books project especially causes him mixed emotions.
Google is trying something extraordinary, and they're to be congratulated and encouraged in every possible way to do this extraordinary thing, but this is the moment to take a look.
Lethem and a handful of other authors have signed on to an effort challenging Google to guarantee that readers of its virtual library will have as much privacy as they had in traditional libraries. One of the organizers of this effort is the digital civil liberties group called the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Legal director Cindy Cohn says a system like Google Books can track your reading very closely.
They know what books you search for, what books you might browse through. They know how long you spend on each page.
In other words, the same kind of information that they know about your web searches. But books should be different, Cohn says. She wants Google to throw away as quickly as possible all the data left behind by book readers. Otherwise, she says, Google Books could become a one-stop shop for anyone trying to dig into your reading habits. Daphne Keller is familiar with those nightmare scenarios.
There's this horrific example of, like, what if your insurance company finds out about the diseases you're researching, which is just not going to happen.
Keller is a lawyer for Google.
It's not going to happen because the regular Google privacy policy says that we don't disclose your personal information except in some really narrow circumstances like emergencies and search warrants.
But a corporate privacy policy isn't enough for Cindy Cohn.
I just think that books and the future of reading is too important to be left to a just trust us version of privacy.
Cohn says now is the time for them to pressure Google because the company is trying to get court approval for a complicated copyright settlement with publishers and authors. The EFF and the ACLU of Northern California are threatening to go to the judge overseeing the settlement and ask that legally binding privacy guarantees be included. Google lawyer Daphne Keller says while the company believes in protecting customers' privacy, it does not think this settlement is the place to make that kind of commitment.
It would be weird to put it in the agreement. You know, it's certainly not the kind of thing that would generally come up in the settlement of a copyright conflict.
But Google needs this settlement. Without it, it may not have the right to post millions of the books that it's already scanned. It's a sensitive moment for the company, and privacy groups know that this is a rare chance to build legally binding reader protections into what could someday become the world's library. Martin Kosty, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Madeline Brand in California.
I'm Melissa Block in Washington. And Madeline, how many physicists do you think it takes to fix the world's biggest particle collider?
Melissa, is this one of your physicist jokes?
I think it might be, and I actually have no idea what the punchline would be. But I can tell you this. The giant machine broke down last fall, and high-energy physics went on hold. Now, Europe's high-energy physics lab, CERN, has announced plans to restart the collider, and NPR's Jeff Brumfiel is going to tell us all about it.
If you want to see something really new in high-energy physics, you've got to go big, and that's where the Large Hadron Collider comes in. The LHC is nearly 17 miles around. It accelerates ordinary particles to near the speed of light and smashes them together. Researchers hope that studying the subatomic shrapnel from those collisions will bring them closer to a theory of everything. It might also reveal other things like dark matter. That's the strange stuff that glues galaxies together. The LHC is vastly complicated, which is why it's so amazing that last September, scientists got particles whizzing around the ring on the very first try.
Okay, three, two, one, go.
Two spots! Fantastic!
That's really fantastic.
It all went so smoothly that researchers were expecting the particles to start colliding right away. Joe Licken is a theoretical physicist at Fermilab near Chicago.
We were actually betting on when the first collisions would happen. We had a pool going on whether it would be tomorrow or next week or 2 weeks from now.
9 days later, all bets were off. A faulty connection caused a massive electrical short. Repairing the mess has taken most of the year. Now, to understand what this means for high-energy physics, you have to understand that the LHC is pretty much the only game in town. Fermilab also has a working collider, but it's only a fraction as powerful. That makes it a lot harder to find the really cool stuff everyone wants to study, like dark matter.
It's very disconcerting for all of us in terms of planning our lives. We want to be there when the exciting things are happening, but we can't afford to just hang around in Geneva forever and wait for years and years for these things to come up and run.
Top researchers can go work on something else for a while, but junior scientists need the LHC.
The people that it really hurts are the young people, especially the graduate students, who were hoping to have LHC data to analyze in order to finish their PhD theses and become famous and get jobs.
Don't let me say anything that destroys my career.
That's Sarah Lockwitz. She and her husband are both graduate students at Yale. They moved near Geneva to be closer to the collider. They needed its data to finish their PhDs. But the delays have made that impossible. So this summer, they made a big decision. They left Switzerland for Illinois. to get data from the smaller collider at Fermilab.
On the Geneva side, we had to sell everything for, you know, pennies on the dollar or pennies on the euro or whatever you want to say to try and get out of there in a couple of weeks. And we just came over with two suitcases and landed and realized, like, the car we left behind didn't work. So we used cash for clunkers and got a new car and drove over to Chicago.
They're not alone. An increasing number of American graduate students are moving back to Fermilab. Others are just having to wait. It's not ideal, says Joe Licken.
We shrug our shoulders. What else can we do? You don't just switch on a machine like the LHC and have it run smoothly on day one. It's just not the way these things work.
When the LHC switches on again in November, it'll be at energies too low to see very much. But for the waiting physicists, low energies are better than no energies. Jeff Brumfield, NPR News.
As economic models for the news business crack apart, media executives from competing outlets are sharing their headaches behind closed doors at one of the nation's leading journalism schools. NPR's David Falkenflik was recently allowed to observe and offers us this look at the quest to find solutions.
Up on the sixth floor of the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism, these folks sure don't sound like those arrogant leaders of media giants that we keep hearing about. Richard Porter, director of news content for BBC World News, delivers an update on his efforts to drive some of its millions of TV viewers to its websites.
I'm past the end of the beginning. I don't think I'm greatly much further than that.
Porter is laying out his challenge to 18 other media executives from outlets large and small.
The marketing and creative teams that I work with have really, really got this and bought into it big time.
Among those present are people from news organizations that also have an international reach, the Associated Press, the New York Times, and Time.com. Longtime management consultant Doug Smith says it's pretty clear why these hard-nosed news executives are willing to share their secrets.
It's chaos out there. There's definitely a sense of terror.
Smith is the executive director of the Sulzberger News Media Executive Leadership Program at Columbia, now in its third year. The program helps news companies develop targeted strategies for change. A few months ago, the Christian Science Monitor became the first nationally distributed newspaper to scrap its daily edition in favor of its website. It was considered a radical step for the esteemed but wilting publication, worked out right in front of its peers with Smith's genial guidance.
You're seeing industry change before your eyes. And I think that that makes it rational to say we all want to find a more sustainable future. To some degree, let's find it together.
They adhere to Las Vegas rules. What's said at the J School stays at the J School. One of this year's fellows is Ray Pierce, vice president for circulation at the New York Times. Pierce says the Vegas rules make him comfortable as he shapes his approach to distributing the Times on electronic readers.
We started the program. A lot of the goals were sort of lofty statements and sounded wonderful. And what Doug and his team do is they force you to focus on, okay, that's great, but what are you trying to deliver?
ABC News president David Weston knew what he wanted his executives to remedy. Budget pressures over the past two decades have forced the network to cut back its coverage of foreign news.
Ultimately, we want to put on good stories, wherever they're from. The most interesting, most important stories we can find. But we have to find them. And I was worried that the cost of the major bureaus was getting in the way of our finding those good stories.
The standard for the gold-plated bureau, Weston says, was set under Kennedy White House spokesman turned Paris bureau chief, Pierre Salinger.
And at that point, I'm told we had both a wine cellar and a full-time chef.
Those days are long gone. Now you see a cadre of younger, less familiar reporters.
I'm Karen Russo in Surat, India. The global economic crisis has reached the...
They're one-person bands, armed with light digital cameras, and they file stories and raw footage for newscasts, radio, webcasts, and podcasts from eight spots around the world where the network would otherwise have no presence. New media guru Jeff Jarvis admires the innovation, but he says that kind of change may not be radical enough. Jarvis heads the interactive news program at the City University of New York's Graduate School of Journalism, also here in Manhattan. Jarvis praises the Monitor's decision to kill its daily edition, but asks why the Boston Globe, another participant in the Columbia program, doesn't also consider stopping the presses.
If all we're doing is incrementally fixing problems in the current old models, that's futile and fatal.
Saving a little more money or making a few more pennies is not going to bring news into this next generation. We have to reinvent journalism and the news business for a new, profitable future.
But Columbia's Doug Smith says it's unrealistic to think of changing an entire industry. His own prescription involves looking at each news outlet individually. He says you have to fix one company at a time.
Yeah, I think it's terrific when there are panels and forums and opinion pieces and things that throw great ideas into the mix. My experience is that it takes more than ideas to create a sustainable future. You have to implement those ideas.
Smith says they've thrived by turning competitors into collaborators at Columbia. And ABC's David Weston suggests you think this way about the news business during these tough economic times. It's much more like playing golf than tennis. You compete against the course. David Folkenflik, NPR News, New York.
Tomorrow, David reports on ABC's efforts to strike a new tone for a digital audience.